I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The author and critic Anna Canis Schofield joins me now. Her first novel was published earlier this year, Malarkey. Here's how it's described at the back of the book. Malarkey is the story of an Irish mother forced to look grief in the eye and of a wife coming face to face with the mad agony of longing. I'll get Miss Schofield to tell us about the book, what the process was like in writing it. It took something like 10 years to do it. And the reception to it thus far, which I can report has been quite good. I've known Anna Canis Schofield for a couple of years now. I saw her on a panel at the Vancouver Writers Festival discussing books from this part of the world, Vancouver, British Columbia, and in general the West Coast. I was struck at her keenness in arriving here as an immigrant from Ireland and Britain and finding solace and knowledge, wisdom perhaps, from the literature of this place, which was new to her. I greatly admire that in her, and I'm very pleased to have her on the program today. It'll be interesting to find out if what she's read about this place when coming here a few years ago informed the writing of this book. The website for more is at malarkey.ca. The book is published by Biblioasis. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Anna Canis Schofield. Ms. Schofield, good morning.
Oh, hello, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
Is it Joe or Joseph?
Joe is fine.
Joe.
Yeah. I must say, I really, when I saw you a couple years ago on that panel with Daniel Francis and Jean Barman, I really greatly admired the passion that you have for the books of this place, and it introduced me to some, I guess Taxi is something that you're a big fan of.
That's right, Helen Putrabenko's 1975 novel Taxi, originally published by New Star.
Yeah,
it's been very important to me, that novel, in terms of adjusting to where I am.
Yeah,
because of course before I discovered that novel, I was much more maladjusted.
Yeah, and that's important, isn't it, when you come to a place?
Well, yes, it is, and I think Vancouver especially can be discombobulating because you cannot see the past so easily in the buildings and the city of the present. And what these novels and a lot of the local literature affords us is an entry. And as soon as you have an entry, you know, you have different facades. You look at a building in a different way, or, you know, you see periods of history ahead of you when you're wandering about. I mean, in other cities, it's much more obvious because they just maybe haven't changed as radically. So I found that enormously helpful myself in breaking in psychologically to Vancouver, my new home.
Yeah, I'm 30 and I've lived here my whole life. But I you do have to go back to understand this place. And, you know, you could live here 40, 50 years.
Well, I think there's a gross misconception as well that there's no history in a city like Vancouver, which is, of course, a nonsense. As soon as you dig, you find the fascinating history. And especially for me, I relate very strongly to the labor history here. That's been, you know, critical in, like I say, just helping me feel better and attached to where I live. Prior to that, I think I was adrift, let's say, and living psychologically in and elsewhere, which is very difficult, you know.
Yeah.
And I think I've talked to many, many people, and not just immigrants from other countries, people that come from other places in Canada to Vancouver, who, again, describe this sense of dislocation. And I often now sort of encourage them to read Taxi, to read novels that offer us an entry point, and encourage them to engage with that tension.
So this book, Malarkey, is about a woman who's a wife and a mother. As I said, I'm 30 and a male. Do you think if I read the book, I'll understand women better?
I hope you'll. First of all, I hope you'll. I hope you'll appreciate the writing.
Yeah.
I hope you'll, engage with what the language offers. Malarkey is a portrait of one ordinary, extraordinary woman in rural Ireland, in the west of Ireland, who's determined not to be sunk, basically. Fiction is not a place where we legislate things. Fiction's a place, it's a place of the imagination. So I hope you'll understand women more, but, you know, I offer no guarantees.
Yeah.
I mean, the portrait in Malarkey is also that of a mother and a son, and it explores the mother's response to the son's homosexuality and her own response to her own sexuality. So there, you know, as well as Middle Eastern politics and, you know, the war in Afghanistan, I mean, the list of things in this book is fairly endless. So, you know, I hope, I hope you would get something like that from it.
I mean, it's a bit unfair to ask the author what they expect the reader to get out of it, right?
Well, the wonderful thing for the author is what the reader brings to the book.
Yeah.
So, I've had lovely emails and letters from strangers. I had one in particular that moved me a great deal from a woman in Agassiz, B.C. one Sunday morning, and she wrote to me and she said her father had suffered from dementia, and she had found great strength reading Malarkey because she felt that after she read of the main character in Malarkey is called Our Woman, and she experiences all kinds of challenges that she rises to and explores, and she said she felt like her father may have, underneath his dementia, something of himself may still have remained, and she got great strength from reading my book, even though my book is really nothing to do with, you know, aging males and dementia.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't deal with dementia at all. It deals with a psychological unraveling and grief. It's a portrait of a very grief-stricken mother and wife. And then she said at the end of the message, she was going, it was a beautiful day in Agassiz, she said. She said she was going to go out for a walk and she was going to think about our woman's life. And I found that just profoundly moving, that somebody would have taken to my book and would take my book into the highways and byways of Agassiz on a Sunday morning and think about it.
Yeah. The other theme in the book that you discuss is isolation.
Yes, certainly. And yes.
And what do you think you've uncovered, say, about that? And it, I guess it's...
Well, people are very, very isolated with grief.
Yeah.
Grief in its very nature is isolating. So, and then every significant loss that you concurrently experience, somebody that experiences significant grief, such as a child, a husband, a sibling, most of us do and have, then any concurrent death will be even more pronounced because grief accumulates. So the book is told in a way that, as well, isolates that sense of accumulation and that sense of discombobulation. So you'll essentially, I think, always feel alone when you're grieving. It's not, you may find brief moments of comfort with other people who knew the person, but grief in its very nature is an isolating process. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And from the reviews I've read of the book, people are saying that the emotions that are in the book are told quite strongly. I mean, in the book she goes mad. She suffers from grief.
Well, I don't think it's fair to say she goes mad. I would say she experiences an unraveling.
Right.
A psychological...
Like a breakdown.
A breakdown, yeah. A breakdown, which... Given everything that she's confronted with, the death of her husband and then the death of her son, is not an extraordinary response, really.
Yeah. And where does it come from as the writer? I mean, do you go through some of the same things that your character goes through?
It's an imagining, right? It's a fictional portrait. I would say I had something very significant to say about the topic of grief. So where does it come from as a writer? It's something that interests me profoundly. I'm very interested in mortality, and I suppose I'm interested in the way that we never confront our mortality. And our mortality is essentially confronted by those around us after we're gone. And I've often wondered whether a life should be lived confronting mortality so that by the time that it arrives, we're better adjusted to it. You know, grief is something I've experienced. My father died when I was 6 or 5 and a half. So it was something that I had to learn to understand or I had to struggle with. And, you know, I talk to a lot of people just here and there on the streets and in cafes. And I'm always struck by by loneliness and isolation as well. It's something that really interests me. Ordinary people interest me a great, great deal. And I find extraordinary, you know, I find, you know, exchanging with ordinary people very fulfilling. I'm often struck by images of people just around me or passing me and, you know, wondering about what they're thinking.
Yeah.
You know, rather than, you know, I guess I'm interested in the quiet people.
Yeah.
Maybe because I'm kind of loud.
Yeah. But I guess our woman, Philomena, she's if we saw her on the street, she would be sort of a nondescript, just a regular person, if you will, right?
Yeah, she's someone that you know very, very well. Okay, you may not know her in this context because she's in rural Ireland and she's a farmer. She's a farmer's wife, basically. So, I mean, it's possible that, you know, you might not meet precisely Philomena unless you went to rural Ireland or, you know, Ireland. But I think she exists in every place. And when I wrote Malarkey, you know, this book was made in Canada. I had moved from Dublin to Vancouver, and I struggled for many, many years to write this book. But I conceived of it all along, not necessarily as an Irish novel. I conceived that this woman could be in Campbell River. In fact, Campbell River was a place I thought of a lot in terms of BC. And so that's one of the reasons why I was so touched when this woman, retired woman from Agassiz, wrote to me, because I felt like, okay, I wrote this book for you, and you found it. You know, I think she's everywhere. I think she may be your mother, she may be your aunt, she could be, you know, in any culture she exists. You know, and we don't know we don't really know so much about these kinds of women. They don't often play a mainstream sort of protagonist role in novels. I mean, actually, in Canadian literature, that's probably less true. We've got, somebody was telling me about Margaret Lawrence's work, and I mean, Helen Potrebenko's work is full of wonderful women characters, and, you know, we've got wonderful women writers in Canada. But I was interested because the novel that I wrote is episodic, it's fragmented, but it's also unremitting in its portraits and its fixation on giving you just this one woman. You know, I don't kind of relent. You're inside her kidneys, you're inside her mind. And that's deliberate. I wanted to give this sense of wholeness and not give some sort of diluted portrait whereby she's, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
She's just there's just fractions of her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting because I give you her in a fractional way, but you really get all of her.
You get the sense of her, I guess, right?
Yeah. You know, it's pretty unremitting.
Yeah. The story takes place in Ireland.
That's correct.
But you created the book you created the book here in Canada. It's still a Canadian story, don't you think? It's something that, I mean, the woman in Agassiz that you've been talking about.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I feel like and I feel quite excited that it would be taught as Canadian literature. I'm very excited that it could be, that it's Can-lit. And I'm excited, I mean, I think that there's a universal in what I'm talking about. You'll notice that there are not flamboyant, decorative pictures of Ireland that I create in the book. It's a novel about, I mean, one of the things that has interested me so much in Vancouver and BC literature is this, and something that I read for very often, is how we discern a place in literature by the way the people speak and behave in that place, rather than us being described, the place being clinically described. So I'm quite interested in the portrait of place through the behavior of the people that live there. And there's a wonderful D.M. Fraser story. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he's a very significant Vancouver writer.
Mm-hmm.
And he there was one story in particular where he, one of his short stories, now what's the name of it? It's gone out of my head. But he has a description of people just moving along the street or coming out of a shop or something. And it's so quintessentially Vancouver. And yet, there's nowhere in the story that necessarily states that it's taking place in Vancouver. So I like those little nuggets, you know?
How often do you go back to Ireland?
I try to go on an annual basis, but financially it can be tough. You know, so I do get back you know, a lot. My family are there, and I like to go and visit my mother and, you know, try to help her if I can around the farm.
Yeah, is it still home for you, though, when you get there? Do you still feel an affinity for it? I mean, you feel an affinity for it, but does it feel like home?
Well, Dublin was really where I've lived the most. Most of the time that I've ever lived in Ireland, I spent in Dublin, and I do have a strong attachment to Dublin, and, I mean, more essentially to the group of people I know there, because I've known them for a long time. They've known me since I was 20, right, or, you know, sometimes longer. So, yeah, I'm very, very attached to those friendships, and there's a certain rearranging of my brain chemicals that happens when I go back there, because, I mean, you know, you can just, I don't know, I mean, I just have a lot of fun,
yeah.
Even just, whatever, standing at the bus stop or whatever, not to be getting romantic or anything, because, you know, I was talking to a girlfriend of mine this year over there, and we were laughing because we had this mad experience in a print shop, and she was saying to me, because I was saying, oh, it's classic Dublin, and she said, no, because these things only happen when I'm with you.
Yeah.
I don't know whether, you know, that's par for the course or whether that's just my experience. But, you know, I've increasingly in more recent years felt at home here in Vancouver. You know, and I think it's to do with the work that I did around the uncovering of forgotten novels, and I also did another curatorial project with Unit Pit, which is a local artist-run centre, where we interrogated an event in Vancouver Labour history. So that required me to do a lot of reading in rare books, and I curated some artists, and we did this series of public actions that were called Rereading the Riot Act, one of which coincided with the night of the Stanley Cup riot. So there was a lovely conflating of events there. So that, doing that work and making more of a concerted effort to understand where I live has created, you know, a sense of belonging here.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of belonging, and I still do struggle often just with the, I mean, there's a certain...
figuring what it is?
Well, there's a prickliness around you know, if you... you're in the street in Vancouver sometimes and you throw out a comment to a stranger, you know, depending obviously on the circumstance and the place you are, you can sometimes be met with no response whatsoever, or you can be met with, you know, a terrified response, or you can be met with a very warm response. And I do struggle with that, you know. I mean, in that I just would prefer that people were more interactive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know... You turn another corner and you have a totally different experience. And I've experienced great kindness here and great generosity. And one of the things that really has buoyed me about, you know, being here is the response to my novel here. I've had such incredible support from the local literary community and just local people. You know, my book has been so warmly embraced, and I've done wonderful readings. The Vancouver Writers Festival invited me, and I was at their literary cabaret, and it was just fabulous. So, you know, I can't say enough about how supportive the writing community has been here, and the poets especially. I mean, we have a wonderful poetry scene here, and I've had just fabulous support. And, you know, I've been on tour, on five different tours this year with this novel. It's been very successful, and I've been in the U.S., and I've been in Canada, and it's always lovely to do an event in Vancouver because it's like a homecoming, and like I just feel so warmly supported here.
Yeah, it's a great scene, isn't it? I mean, I interview authors of all stripe from here, and I'm always struck at how the sense of community there is.
Yeah, I think it is. I don't think I was really aware of it.
And it also includes readers too, not just
the readers,
you know,
are. Yeah, the readers are great, and you can have. And I've been meeting readers. For example, I keep meeting a couple of people who originally came to our taxi event at the Vancouver Public Library, which was maybe, could it be 5 years ago? And I've met people consistently at my readings. So there's this lovely core group of readers who have engaged with the taxi novel, Betty Lambert's novel. We did some work around that. And now are coming and supporting Malarkey and, you know, it's, yeah, it's very uplifting. And I agree with you. I think I wasn't aware how supportive the scene can be until this year, because I was always quite frustrated at the at the lack of, sometimes at the lack of response to things that I'd instigate. But I think these things really do take time. That's kind of what I've learned.
Yeah.
They do take time, and you kind of have to bring people along with you. So you have to be an advocate, and you do need to engage. And I think that this is one of the wonderful things about Vancouver that maybe doesn't exist in other cities like London or Dublin, or is much tougher in those cities. What I found in Vancouver is if you create a space and you go in and you make a little space, then people will come and join you. Whereas in other cities, you maybe might not be able to do that because, you know, they're just so colossal and there's just so much happening. And, you know, whereas in Vancouver, I think there is a lot of space. And if you go in and you take up a bit of space with something that you're interested in, you'll be surprised at how responsive people will be. Yeah, I have to say I've become maybe more attached to the place since I published this book.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's really been wonderful this year. Good Lord.
Yeah. Now, the title of the book is Malarkey.
Yes.
That's a word that, I mean, in recent weeks we've heard it again when the Vice President invoked it during his debate with Paul Ryan.
Well, obviously, the story there was that Joe Biden had read my book.
Yeah, exactly.
Identified with the character Philomena, our woman, recognized that Barack Obama was in the trenches and needed to be pulled up by his britches, and invoked Philomena. And we see a clear path from Malarkey the novel to Joe Biden and the victory in the vice presidential debate. I mean, that's a given.
Yeah, so the next printing, I guess he'll have a blurb in the back, right?
I tell you, somebody actually made a wonderful meme with Joe Biden holding my book up
in the
air.
That,
yeah, and then somebody else commented that he was beating young voters over the head with it.
So when he used it in the debate, I guess he was using it in the Irish American sense, that it's I guess bullshit, I guess is the what.
Well, yes, the word I technically means nonsense.
Yeah.
It's a word that my mother used to use, and I've heard it a lot. Oh, you know, stop that malarkey. But for a long time, my novel was actually called Chinook, after the military helicopter. But that became problematic because there's a weather system in Alberta called a Chinook, and that was fine because I love weather.
Yeah.
But then people kept talking about the salmon.
Right.
And in the West Coast, we identify with the word with the salmon. So that would just be too, you know, bizarre. And then the word, I had used the word in the novel, and when I was editing it, I remember saying to a friend, Malarkey, oh, that would be a great title, and the person said, yes, it would. So I surveyed a few other people. But I really conceived of it as meaning behavior, carry on, like stop that carry on, stop that malarkey. You know. So I kind of, as usual, had my own very obscure interpretation of the word, and then had to come to terms with the actual meaning of it by opening up the dictionary after the book was published. But it's close enough. And it's funny because I think it's Well, it's a very useful title because it's easy to remember, and it's got something of the kind of spiritedness that the woman in the book possesses. So I like that, you know. So I'm happy with the title, Joe.
Yeah, it's a great title.
And Joe Biden, the other Joe, who's you know, has been stumping for this book, and I'm grateful to him.
Yeah. In terms of the writing process, and now that you've published this, I know that it was an arduous 10 years to get this out.
Yeah,
now that it's out there, has that changed how you write? Say,
Well, one of the great things, the only good thing about taking 10 years to complete a work is you do a lot of work. So, you know, I have other work. Because I've been struggling for so long. So, yes, in that regard, I wrote essentially three books to write Malarkey. The first book was New York set, more of a historical Irish story set in New York in the 60s. I'm not sure I'm going to be reviving that one. I think I'll just let that one be buried. But there's a footnote novel to Malarkey that you know, I'm working on, potentially. I don't know if I'll ever be satisfied with it, though. The problem is I'm perpetually dissatisfied, and that's why it took me so long. But it seems to have worked out okay.
It has, yeah.
You know, because I could have put out a much more sort of mediocre, piece that I was, I was satisfied with, and then, you know, I might not have had such a warm response.
Yeah.
And it certainly helps to have people engaging with your book and really striving to understand it. And, you know, it really has been amazing. I mean, in the U.S., I was a Barnes & Noble pick. I mean, and this is a book that's published by a small, you know, an independent literary Canadian press with, you know, just a couple of members of staff. So,
yeah.
You know, this was, you know, they've worked so, so hard on this book. And, you know, yesterday Amazon chose it as one of their best books of the year, I heard.
Congratulations.
You know, and you know, there's other exciting things going on, with it. So I feel very blessed. I really do.
Do you read the reviews?
Well, being writing criticism myself, I do. I do read the reviews. And I read a lot of literary criticism.
Mm-hmm.
I think critique is very important. You know, it is a separate form of writing. It should be read in that way.
Does it affect you, though, as a writer, say, if a reviewer doesn't like the book, and not that there have been any reviews like that?
Well, you know, I've been extremely fortunate. That said, I think an informed critique is always appreciated. I think, you know, an ignorant, you know, why haven't you written a crime novel type review, you know, that just, usually that speaks more to the person that wrote it. I mean, you know, I crave, you know, intelligent, articulate criticism. And that, you know, whether it's about my work or somebody else's work, I'm never going to be reductive about that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have learned how to become a better writer through reading long-form essays in the London Review of Books and in the New York Review of Books especially, and all kinds of publications, because, you know, those essays feed me. They make me think critically. They make me reconsider literature. And that's the way in which I work. I kind of come from a reading perspective out, not necessarily a workshopping perspective. I prefer, you know, to learn by reading other writers. And from a point of view of interest, I have a kind of frenetic appetite for completely redundant information. So, you know, that usually sets me off in terms of fiction and novel writing.
Yeah.
It's not great. I don't recommend it. But, you know, there are all kinds of ways. So, you know, I think I put a high priority on criticism.
Yeah.
I wish we had more higher quality thinking criticism in Canada. I really wish we did.
More outlets for it, especially.
Yeah, and properly paid outlets and long-form essays and, you know, but there's a lot of things that we do have here that other countries and cities don't have. I think we're extremely fortunate with our, you know, astonishing network of independent presses. I mean, without those independent publishers, you know, Canadian works, I don't know if they'd be very much, you know, because they're you know, and poetry. I mean, all of those poetry presses, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, the big houses obviously do publish Canadian work, but, you know, they won't take as much risk with, say, new avant-garde work, although nowadays it's virtually impossible to get that kind of work published.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things have shifted. I mean, it's a very difficult, very, very difficult time in publishing at the moment.
Yeah.
But there's lots to be hopeful for.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I've certainly been somebody who's benefited enormously from Canadian publishing. You know, I think my book wouldn't exist if it wasn't for it. So, you know, I'm grateful for that.
Well, congratulations on all the success.
You.
I mean, it's so deserved. And continued good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been delightful talking to you. I've been looking forward to this. And as I said, I'm a great admirer of what you do. And so this was fun to do today.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. And I had no idea that you were actually at that Vancouver 125 Legacy Books panel.
Yeah.
That was a great initiative by the Ziffy. I hope they continue to do initiatives like that around art and literature.
Yeah, I found it. I found it so just wonderful, the variety of books that Brad and those people put together. I mean, it was just
yes. It was Michael Turner and Stephen Osborne.
Yeah.
The wonderful, wonderful, I can't say enough good things about her, Jean Barman, who contributed so much to our city history and the literature of our city history. Have you interviewed Jean?
Yeah, she's been on a couple times.
I figured you must have. I just love Jean. And Dan Francis.
Yeah.
And who else was it? And there was somebody else, wasn't there?
Yeah, I don't really remember.
It's gone out of my head.
Yeah.
There were five of us there. No, that was it.
Yeah.
I think there was
Brad
Pitt. Brad Cran.
Well, he'll like that. He'll like that you thought it was Brad
Pitt.
Yeah.
Who's just invented an eco-tac. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I saw the email, yeah.
Yeah, he's just invented a new carbon tax software.
Carbon-free, yeah.
Carbon-free, yeah. So you can now do your taxes and they'll calculate your carbon footprint.
Yeah.
He's such a pioneer.
Just an amazing mind.
He's always coming up with something, isn't he?
Yeah,
so, no, it was a great time. I really enjoyed that panel.
Yeah. The website for more, malarkey.ca. The book is called Malarkey. It's published by Biblioasis. I'm looking forward to finishing it. Its author, Anna Kenneth Schofield, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.